If you're gay, then you're gay. Don't pretend that you're straight. You could be who you are any day of the week. You are unlike the others, so strong and unique. We're all with you.
If you're straight, well, that's great. You can help procreate and make gay little babies for the whole human race. Make a world we can live in where the one who you love's not an issue. Cause we're all somewhere in the middle. We're all just looking for love to change the world. Ah. And we're all here in it together.
Thanks for tuning in, and welcome to IMRU Radio Magazine, out front and out loud since 1974, striving each week to amplify the voices of the LGBTQIA2S+ communities. I'm David Hunt in Raleigh, North Carolina. According to the author John C. Maxwell, a leader is one who knows the way, goes the way, and shows the way. Tonight we examine three leaders of our movement, Jean Cordova, Carla Jay, and Bayard Rustin. Carla Jay is a distinguished professor emerita at Pace University, where she taught English and directed the Women's and Gender Study Program between 1974 and 2009. A pioneer in the field of lesbian and gay studies, she's the author of a number of books, most notably, Tales of the Lavender Menace, a memoir of liberation.
Carla Jay was already a member of the feminist action group Red Stockings, as well as the early lesbian organization Daughters of Bilitis, when in 1969, in the wake of the Stonewall riots, she joined the just-forming Gay Liberation Front, GLF. We're meeting in Midtown New York City for a chat about the future and the past.
I'm Carla Jay. I'm the author, editor, and translator of 10 books, the most recent of which is Tales of the Lavender Menace, a Memoir of Liberation. I also edited 24 books for NYU Press for a series called The Cutting Edge, Lesbian Life and Literature. I just retired from Pace University after 39 years of teaching English, women's studies, and queer studies.
How did you become an activist?
I really became caught up in historical events. For one thing, I went to Barnard, which was part of Columbia, and I just happened to be there during the Columbia uprisings. And it was the total injustice of the New York City Tactical Police Force, which rounded up the innocent and the guilty alike, which thrust me into the movement. There's nothing like being out there on the campus and being chased around by police to see friends arrested and beaten up for doing nothing mostly, and also to be treated badly by the men who thought that women's place in the movement was to sleep with them and to provide peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. That was a great way to make a feminist out of anyone. So a lot of us came out of this uprising as feminists, as pacifists. And also another important thing that happened to me when I was in college was that Malcolm X came to Barnard to speak in February, I think it was in 1964, and 2 days later he was dead. And I met him 2 days before his assassination. And it was just such a colossal event, you know, to meet someone who was then assassinated and who was really, at that moment in his life, reaching out to, you know, white college kids like me. It was really quite phenomenal for me. And I really was very interested in the civil rights movement as well. Then I heard about the women's movement, and that feminists were forming groups, you know, Red Stockings, New York Radical Feminists. And I went to an event where different feminist groups were recruiting. And I decided to go with a radical group called Red Stockings, which had developed something called consciousness raising, which they had borrowed from the mainland Chinese, as we called them back then. And in China, it was called speaking bitterness. So I joined consciousness raising, and there were a lot of very interesting people in that group, including Rita Mae Brown, Alex K. Shulman, both of whom are well-known writers. And we analyzed things that we had never discussed before as women, things about how we were raised differently as men and women. We just never had spoken of that, being raised as boys and girls, and relationships and our education and how that might have been different because of our gender. Today, of course, people speak of these things, but people really had never spoken of these things. And we wrote position papers, and we also did a lot of work around abortion, which was illegal. However, the feminist movement was homophobic. It was also somewhat classist. They were middle-class white ladies. They weren't particularly interested in the civil rights movement. And they certainly weren't interested in lesbians. Although Red Stockings created the saying, the personal is political, when it came to lesbians, they thought the personal was personal and they didn't want to hear about it. So when Stonewall happened and the Gay Liberation Front formed shortly thereafter, I didn't walk over there. I ran over there to join the Gay Liberation Front. And that's how I became not just a radical feminist, I became a radical gay activist.
You know, in the 1960s, it seemed possible that anyone could change the world. How do you explain that era to millennials?
I don't think that young people today can understand what our lives were like in the 1960s. When I was at Barnard, a lesbian could be thrown out for being a lesbian. Women's colleges in particular were homophobic because they didn't want to be known as hotbeds of lesbians. You could be arrested if there were a raid on a bar. Even if you were not arrested in the bar raid because you had the right ID and you were of legal age, which was of 18 at the time in New York, and you were wearing the proper clothing, if they got any information off you, if they got your name, if they got your address, and they found out your employer or your school or where you lived, you would lose your apartment, you would lose your job, your family would kick you out. You could simply lose everything, your marriage, your children, anything you had, you would lose. We had no rights at all. We couldn't find each other because words like homosexual or gay or lesbian, which came along with the Gay Liberation Front, could not be printed in any newspaper or in the Yellow Pages, which preceded the internet. And so we couldn't find each other. It was really this time of loneliness and isolation, and many people were ashamed of each other or of themselves. It was not kind of a happy time for most gay men and lesbians to be who we were. So it's hard to understand that today. When we first met the Gay Liberation Front, there were some people, interestingly enough, who expressed the desire when we said, what do we want? Some people actually said they wanted to get married. But more people said, I would really just like to be able to hold my lover's hand and not be beaten up. You know, that seemed like a far more realistic goal. I never thought that we'd have the right to get married in my lifetime. I'm thrilled that we do. It really wasn't a primary goal. Like John Waters, you know, I thought that not having to go in the military was one of the perks of being gay and maybe not having to get married, which was his other comment. But I'm thrilled that people can get married. It's a complicated issue. It certainly wasn't my own first priority. We wanted to live in peace at a time when people were being persecuted. And we also have to remember that there were people in our movement who were killed for being out there and working for the movement.
This is Steve Pride, and I'm talking to pioneering LGBT activist Carla Jay. Besides your work in New York, you were involved in the very first Pride Parade in Los Angeles.
The GLF, we organized the parade in 1970, and I was actually in the first poster that organized the picnic the day before, the Saturday before the parade, and we advertised that we had a picnic at Griffith Park. So we had a big picnic, and then we had a parade going down, what was it, Hollywood Boulevard or something. It wasn't a long parade. The difference between the parade in Los Angeles and the parade in New York, we called them a march back then because we thought of them as being political rather than being, you know, the Thanksgiving Day parade. We had banners, you know, mostly homemade with markers and things like that, was that in Los Angeles, there were some floats, even in the first march. And they had this float with a tube of Vaseline on it, which I could not believe. that they had something like that. It was very in your face. And that was like KY of 1969, 1970. This was in June of 1970. And we had this march, and we were kind of afraid there would be violence. My strategy was always to stay smack in the middle of the crowd, because if you were like at the edge close to the people who were the onlookers, you were much more likely to be hit by a bottle or somebody could throw beer at you or something like that. And we did walk and it went really well, and there was a very thin crowd, maybe one deep, you know, of people who were out there mostly cheering us on. We were booed by some people. And around that event, there was also a sit-in at the Federal Building, where we camped for several days asking for rights. And there was fasting going on. And we sat out there for several days and nights at the Federal Building. And Troy Perry was the spokesperson for that event, although he went home for showers. The rest of us stayed there while he got to shower. We were going to fast until there were rights for lesbians and gay men. But obviously, we gave in.
As a movement, what's our biggest challenge?
One of the problems of the gay movement back in 1969, and maybe today, is that we have very tenuous bonds. What is it that holds us together? We like people of the same sex. This is LG, some B people, and not all people who are I or T. And what holds us all together is that we are oppressed by some people in society at large as queer. And that's a very tenuous bond. We don't come from the same class. We don't come from the same race. We don't come from the same religious background. We don't have the same educational background. And so what held people in, for example, the Black civil rights movement together does not hold us together. And this is one reason why the Black movement could have a leader like Martin Luther King Jr., and we never had a Martin Luther Queen to lead us. When anyone has risen to the top of our movement, we have torn that person down because there is never going to be a person that represents us. And this was the problem from the very beginning. We were in there, you know, Black, white, Latinos, street transvestites, people who had sex in the back of trucks, lesbians who came in off the streets, college-educated, radical feminists like myself, gay men who had been on the Venceslas Ramos brigades, men who came in from Mattachine. We had nothing in common except the fact that we were really angry about what had happened at Stonewall. We wanted to do something, and we couldn't agree on much more. And we tried to hold it together. We did a lot. You know, we had a lot of actions. We created dances. We picketed the New York Times. We had other political actions as well. But the other side of it is, you know, when people say, well, why didn't these groups last? We never intended it to last. We weren't setting up a corporation that was supposed to last in perpetuity. We had no political structure. We didn't even have leaders like a president, vice president. We had a chair for a month whose name was picked out of a hat. That's how I became the head for 1 month. My name was simply picked out of a hat. We were an anarchistic sort of organization. But those same sorts of issues exist today. People need more to act on a micro front. And that's why when groups represent us nationally and they lobby for something nationally to represent us all, no one is ever going to agree with what it is they want to do. Gay men and lesbians in the military? Well, a lot of people are going to like that. And other people are going to say, we don't want to get in the military. You know, if there's ever a war and there's a draft, you have lost your get out of the military free card, you know? So we are never going to agree on anything and everything. And instead of taking activism into our own hands, we've pulled out our credit cards and we've turned over our own lives to large organizations, like, for example, the Human Rights Campaign. We have become lobbyists. And it's not that we shouldn't do that. There is some irony, however, in the fact that Edie Windsor, a single plaintiff, overturned all of these laws when I'm 100% certain that probably large organizations like Lambda Legal Defense, that they were putting together these coalitions of plaintiffs that would represent different categories, let's say, of people who were discriminated against, like veterans and people who couldn't get other kinds of benefits because their marriages weren't recognized by the federal government, for example, Social Security benefits and so on. But that's what many people do. People would rather partake of social events and write out a financial reward for someone to take care of us. Now, for certain things, that makes sense. We can't do cancer research. We can't do HIV research. So, of course, give money to somebody who can do this research for you. There are things that we cannot do. However, in our local communities, there are things we can do. Just to give you one, for instance, I see a lot of activists like myself who, unlike me, didn't have this moment of enlightenment where I said to myself, aha, we never got a dime for what we did. And I said to myself, I got to get a job, you know. I never got any money for activism. I'm not complaining. I did okay. But I see a lot of people I knew from the women's movement, from the LGBTQ movement, who are really badly off. People without whom we wouldn't have marriage. We wouldn't have anything. And if you're out there and you're young, you know, and you can't go over to help an LGBTQ senior for an hour a week, help them shop, help them whatever, do something, then there's really a problem. Say thank you to these people because their being out helped us be out. The people who are older than I am, who are 80, helped me be out.
Carla, any final thoughts you want to share?
What I learned from Gandhi was until you find something you're willing to die for, you don't have something you're willing to live for. And because I inadvertently faced death literally a couple of times, and because I faced the wrath of friends and foes, and faced poverty and lived in poverty, there's nothing that frightens me. The fact that I have lost my eyesight, you're going to have to run me over with a Mack truck to stop me. You know, because I've been so lucky to be in this movement, to have had this life, to have seen these changes, to have met all the people I've met, to have gone the places I've gone, to have seen the changes I've seen. And, you know, I just feel incredibly lucky. And I think that's an amazing thing.
This has been a conversation with legendary lesbian and feminist activist Carla Jay. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Carla Jay is 74 years old now and still works and lives in Brooklyn, New York. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this quick break.
A Friend of Dorothy, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Back in the time when homosexuality was illegal in the U.S., the question, are you a friend of Dorothy, was sometimes used to determine one's sexual orientation without others knowing its meaning. The phrase dates back to the World War II era, and just after the MGM movie The Wizard of Oz was released in 1939. The name Dorothy refers to the character Dorothy Gale in the movie played by the legendary actress and gay icon Judy Garland. In the movie, she sings Over the Rainbow, with the lyrics, if happy little bluebirds fly beyond the rainbow, why oh why can't I? Certainly, these words have been uttered by gay people who have experienced the loneliness of the closet and second-class citizenship status. So if someone asks, are you a friend of Dorothy? Now you know. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Roby Martin.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens from Noah's Ark, and you're listening to IMRU.
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 Well, it's a pleasure to meet you, Leo. It's an honor. You're one of, Hollywood's brightest young stars. I have to say I really liked you in that boat movie. I was wondering if maybe you'd like to come back to my place. I think you're kind of pretty. What do you mean you're not interested? You can't say no to me. I'm Jimmy Stewart. I'm a movie star. You don't say no to Jimmy Stewart, you stupid little pretty boy. What Jimmy Stewart wants, Jimmy Stewart gets. Got it?
Welcome back. I'm David Hunt, and you're listening to IMRU Radio Magazine. Jean Cordova was a trailblazer of the lesbian and gay rights movement, founder of the Lesbian Tide magazine, and a founder of the West Coast LGBT movement. Cordova was a second-wave feminist lesbian activist and a proud butch. She was a Lambda Literary, Publishing Triangle, and Goldie award-winning author of the 2011 memoir, When We Were Outlaws, a memoir of love and revolution.
Born at the dawn of the baby boom generation, Jean Cordova has always been ahead of her time in catching the next wave of social change and taking a visionary leadership role in making a difference. I've known her partner, one of the producers of KPFK's feminist magazine, for years, but never had the opportunity to meet Cordova, the legendary activist, writer, publisher, organizer, and butch icon, until now.
I'm Jean Cordova, author, activist of some 40 years. My first book was when I was a free press columnist. It was called Sexism, It's a Nasty Affair, collection of essays about the early days of women's liberation. And then the second book was a memoir about my years in the convent. It was called Kicking the Habit. The latest book is When We Were Outlaws, a Memoir of Love and Revolution. And it covers a period of time between 1974 and 1977, those 3 years I was an investigative reporter for the Free Press, the LA Free Press, which was the predecessor of the LA Weekly, but far more radical. I was also the publisher of The Lesbian Tide, which was a national feminist lesbian magazine. In this memoir, I backtracked to several big things that happened in 71 and 73, and it's about the politics of the time. As a Free Press reporter, I interviewed Angela Davis and Emily Harris of the Symbionese Liberation Army and a number of people. I was always off in the field, and so the book tells the political story of what were the predominant issues in the mid-70s and early 70s, particularly in the gay liberation and lesbian movement and the New Left.
For Jean, the road to coming out was not only rough, but it took a detour through a nunnery.
My parents were pretty darn bigoted and very Catholic. So it was sort of natural that I go into a convent, being raised in a very Catholic home. But there are two factors. One is I thought I was very much in love with God and Mary and all that. And I probably was. And the second thing is, subconsciously, I really wanted to avoid marriage. And that was the only alternative that seemed to be there. This was before women started working in careers.
At that point, Jean was still in the dark about her sexuality.
Being in a strong Catholic family, I didn't even hear the word. So I didn't know. I actually came out in the convent. That's why I say subconsciously, I wanted to be in a world of women. So that's why a lot of lesbians do go into the nunnery, mostly unconsciously, but they want to avoid the world of men and are attracted to the world of women. And it seems like a real natural choice. And then if you're in love with God and praying all the time, and I was, then it fits. And it's acceptable by your parents.
After she accepted she was a lesbian, Jean left the convent and really began her journey.
I had just come out and I was looking desperately for other gay people. So I looked up in the telephone book and I remembered from high school that gay-looking women were on softball teams. So I joined a softball team. But after a couple of years, I got very bored, and I was in college, and on the team, they called me the college kid, the one going to UCLA. And it just wasn't enough for me. So I got really lonely, and I was saying, aren't there any political or literary lesbians? There must be some somewhere in the world, and I need to find them. Because I was very immersed in social work and working in Watts. And so when I found the DOB quite accidentally, and I walked down those basement steps, it was in the bottom of a church, I remember seeing, oh, here are organized women sitting around talking about homosexuality. They're actually talking about it, and they're talking about the government, and they're talking about dreams about someday not living this way in a basement. And I was thrilled. I just bought the whole package, and I thought, that's where I need to be, and I stayed.
The DOB, or Daughters of Bilitis, was the first lesbian rights organization in the United States. And in the early 1970s, Jean Cordova became involved with a number of LA's early gay and lesbian organizations.
In the beginning, there was nothing, sort of like Genesis. Then I met Morris Kite and a handful of Gay Liberation Front men, one woman, and I had just found the Daughters. I was president of the LA branch, and we kind of fell into talking with each other. The Women's Center, feminism, had just come to LA in 1970 also. So in as far as LA, both the gay movement and the women's movement were kind of born at the same time in LA. They started at different times in New York, the women's movement in 66 and the gays in 69. But by the time we got it out here, I was a lesbian feminist by then. I left DOB. And we start talking. Morris Kite, he was a veteran. He was like 50 years old, which seemed to us 20-year-olds as ancient. And he said, and even the women's movement said, what about building a counterculture? What about making things, organizations? We didn't think about institutions because that was too establishment. But we said, why don't we make places so we can go and all gays can go to these places? And we won't have to live in the straight world. We can live in a world of women or a world of queers. So Morris began making up organizations. And a couple years later, I began also. And like he started the Gay Community Services Center, which is still over there now, and Christopher Street West, the Gay Pride Organization, and Stonewall Democratic Club. And that's just the mid-70s. Those were his babies, and I joined him in a lot of them. Then I started making my own babies, and I guess the first one was the Lesbian Tide magazine. She was my first and eldest child. It started really small, like a DOB newsletter, but it grew into a national voice, and people began asking for it in college towns. That was the interesting thing. I began to notice we'd have, you know, like 25 subscribers from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and then 20 subscribers from a place called Durham, South Carolina. And after a while, it occurred to me, these are all the college towns. And the paper grew and grew, and it became one of the two largest during that decade.
This is Steve Pride, and we're talking to author-activist Jean Cordova.
In 74, I started working as a journalist at the Freep, at the LA Free Press. I came aboard as a columnist because I was a Chicana and a feminist and a dyke. And Art Kunkin, the publisher, thought, oh, that covers three of my bases, you know. But then I morphed into being a human rights editor and an investigative reporter. Luckily, the later publisher, Penny Grenoble, had a lot of faith in me, and so she sent me to interview some really famous people. And it was in the 70s when the SLA, Sudanese Liberation Army, kidnapped Patty Hearst, the summer of 75, and everybody was looking for her. And I was more interested in Patty Hearst's sidekick, Emily Harris, because I think Patty was just a bourgeois lady who happened to get kidnapped because of who her father was. But Emily Harris and Bill Harris, I wanted to know what turned college kids my own age, we were all the same age, like 25, 26 years old, into a revolutionary struggle that included picking up guns. I thought I was in revolutionary struggle and studying Marxism and doing my bit, but I was wondering whether or not I would go into armed struggle. Would I pick up a gun to defend or to further my beliefs? Would I blow up something?
Another of her Freep interviews was with controversial Black Panther anarchist Angela Davis, who Jean suspected was hiding something.
When I met and interviewed Angela Davis, she seemed so obviously, this was 74, she seemed to me so butch and so lesbian. And so I really tried to get her to come out as gay, but she wasn't buying it then.
Becoming well known for her hard-hitting interviews with Emily Harris and Angela Davis led to not only a fanatic following for her column, but an occasional actual fanatic.
So every week, it seemed, people then would start calling up and asking for Cordova. That's how I met my Nazi. He was the local captain of the Almani Nazi Party. Only he was more into armed struggle, so he had placed a couple bombs. And then toward the end of my interviews, he gets killed, and then the FBI comes chasing me into the Free Press office. So I had some pretty wild adventures, and I also learned a lot politically from all those people.
And Jean was there for the start of the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Center. Now a major institution with a $40 million annual budget, its origins were grassroots, and its birth, difficult.
The motivations to starting the center was mostly Don Kilhefner and Morris Kind and John Platania. And their original motivation was to get these street kids coming out of the Midwest who are committing suicide and running away from home. Back then, there was a lot more running away from home and I think less suicide. That's the way it seemed at the time. So Morris and Don wanted to collect all these kids and give them food and jobs and a bed overnight and help them get started in life. And so that was the dawn of GAYA Social Service Center. But we really needed it back then. There were just hundreds or thousands coming out to their families and then being thrown out. So I think that motivation was probably good. It was odd for me to see my mentor, who was an activist, begin to turn into a social services social worker. And I struggled with that and didn't agree with it. And then in terms of people of color or women, the early center, these guys were not very open and didn't understand lesbians at all. And people of color were nowhere to be seen in the early days.
And in the summer of 1975, those differences became too much, and it almost brought an end to the fledgling L.A. Gay and Lesbian Center.
What happened is the government gave the center $939,000, almost $1 million, in 74 for the Alcoholism Center for Women. It's a three-year grant, so $300,000 a year. So the center went out and hired, they had to hire women to run the alcoholism program for women, which still exists today. It's called the Alcoholism Center for Women on Alvarado. So they went out and hired a bunch of us, but they didn't realize that we were feminist. We were gay women, but we had also become feminist. And when we got to GCSC, which was the gay center, it was extremely male-dominated, and there was no way to work yourself up into any administrative posts. There were no lesbians. There's one lesbian on the board of directors, none in management. And so the strike was protesting those things. And it was the time when the center male board could have opened up their arms and welcomed feminist lesbians. And that was the challenge. They could have, but they didn't. They didn't want feminists. They didn't want anything that looked like it was collective or consensus. They wanted to own it, and they did own it. And the strike was about their ownership on the handful of people versus allowing feminism to come and be part of the center. The women's movement was very young, and it was the gay movement's opportunity to accept feminism, even among the men. I mean, nothing wrong with men becoming feminists. And I kind of thought my mentor, Morris Kite, was, I guess because he was so politically advanced in so many ways, like racism and stuff, that I thought he would naturally be a feminist. But they turned us down repeatedly. They fired 16 of their employees that day in May, most of us lesbian feminists. And that's what caused the great strike. We went out and protested. They denied us unemployment. And it's really a story of the women's movement and the gay movement, the beginnings and them clashing, the first major clash in L.A. of those two movements.
Jean went on to start the first Gay and Lesbian Yellow Pages, and at an age when others retire, is still an active LGBTIQ organizer. So what advice does she have for the new generation of activists?
that activism is important and critical for all ages, whether it's Occupy Wall Street now, which I love, or some other movement in 5 years, that activism should be part of, I think, everyone's life, that it's very enhancing. You meet people, you learn about issues, you stay current. And the second thing, I think, is that trying to keep a balance in your life between your work and your relationship is a struggle for activists and others.
This has been a conversation with Jean Cordova. Her new book is called When We Were Outlaws, A Memoir of Love and Revolution. For more information, visit her at jeancordova.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Jean, the roses are red and all of the leaves have gone green and the clouds are so low you can touch them and so come out to the meadow.
Jean Cordova died of cancer on January 10th, 2016 in Los Angeles. She's survived by her partner, Lynn Harris Ballen, producer of Feminist Magazine on KPFK Los Angeles. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this quick break.
Bayard Rustin, Martin Luther King's mentor, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Bayard Rustin was a major player in the civil rights movement. He planned the 1963 March on Washington, which brought more than 200,000 people to the nation's capital to demonstrate for civil rights. It was there that Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech. Rustin was much influenced by a trip he took to India in 1948, where he learned of Mahatma Gandhi's success with nonviolent activism. When he became Martin Luther King's major advisor and mentor, Rustin inspired King to dedicate himself to fighting by nonviolent means. Because Rustin was known to be gay, many white and African American leaders insisted King distance himself from Rustin. This forced Rustin to work behind the scenes, but he nonetheless had a paramount role in the effort to end racial segregation and racial discrimination. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Andrea Westcott.
Hi, I'm David Sedaris, advising you to listen to the longest-running homosexual radio program in Southern California. I am, are you?
Well, what kind of bar is this? Why aren't there any women in here? It's a lot. It's a gay bar. Well, hell, I've had a little fun with the fellows now and then, but, you know, if you're gonna have a bar, you gotta have ladies. Well, of course you can buy me a drink.
Welcome back. I'm David Hunt, and you're listening to IMRU Radio Magazine. Monday was Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and behind every king, there's a queen. In this case, his name was Bayard Rustin.
I'm Walter Nagel, and I am the surviving partner of the late civil human rights activist Bayard Rustin. Bayard Rustin is mainly known for his masterful organizing of the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, which was the platform for one of the most famous speeches of all time, Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. But in 1963, Bayard was already 51 years old, and it's not like he just kind of sprang out of the ground and organized this march. He'd been involved in social justice and peace movements for roughly 30 years. Actually, ever since he was in high school, he was an activist. So over that period, 2-3 decades, he had really honed his skills at organizing nonviolent direct action, usually in small demonstrations, small groups of people, sitting in the South, sitting in at restaurants, riding buses to try and integrate transportation, picketing in front of theaters that wouldn't allow blacks in, things like that. But again, they were usually small groups of people willing to be arrested and willing to go to jail. So by the time the Montgomery bus boycott took off when Rosa Parks sat down, Bayard was really probably the person in the country who was most qualified to really lend sage advice and wisdom to a fledgling movement, which knew something about the philosophy of nonviolence, But the idea of translating it into boots on the ground, if you will, you know, Byard was really able to offer that.
Tell me about Walter before Byard.
I was 27 years old when I met Byard. I had grown up during really the peak years of the civil rights movement, and that was the nightly news. That was the stuff I saw in the newspapers. And as a kind of serious young Catholic kid, I was interested in the idea of approaching conflict nonviolently, you know, living out Christ's message of loving your enemies and not returning violence for violence, turning the other cheek. And, you know, I came of age during both the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War. And when I turned 18, I registered for the draft, but I've tried to apply for conscientious objector status. I wasn't given that status, not because I didn't apply, but the draft board kind of technically messed up. In any case, I ended up turning in my draft card, and I was immediately called for induction, which I refused to report for. So I was spending, you know, 2 or 3 years of my late teens, early 20s, kind of just wondering when I was going to be picked up and jailed for refusing to go. That didn't happen. So I moved to New York City, and I was going to photography school at night, working during the day, a psychiatric hospital I worked in, educational institutions. When I turned 27, I was ready to leave New York, and I was actually on my way to pick up a San Francisco Chronicle to look at the job situation, the apartment situation, when I, quite by chance, met Byard in Times Square. And that changed my life.
Did you know who he was beforehand?
I knew who Byard Rustin was beforehand since I was a teenager, but the man that I looked at, I was not positive. The reason for that is he was known for carrying a walking stick, and in fact, he had been arrested in Times Square carrying a stick with a concealed sword in it at one point. But he didn't have his walking stick with him that day, so, you know, when he introduced himself, of course, I knew who he was.
When did you know he was the one?
It became very clear after we got together a few times and, you know, had dinner and dated, if you will, that we were kind of right for each other. And at that point, I made a decision that I wasn't going to leave the city. I was going to stay with Byard as long as I could.
What was he like?
He was really very warm, very loving, very gentle, wonderful sense of humor, mischievous, if you will. Used to play practical jokes at people at the War Resisters League and the Fellowship of Reconciliation all the time. But I know what you're saying. I mean, you see him in the film clips and things, and he's standing up there being very militant, very forceful, kind of using his finger a la Malcolm X style to make a point. And he could be very militant, but it was always nonviolently so. But as I say, the people that knew him and worked with him, you know, he was just really a great, a fun guy to be around.
I was surprised to find out he was quite a singer.
Byard had a wonderful tenor voice that he really started developing as a teenager. Even though he was raised in the Quaker faith, his grandfather was an AME, African Methodist Episcopal. So he kind of grew up in both traditions. And even though Quakers worship in silence, the AME church doesn't. And so Byard really developed his singing voice as a high school student and was part of the Wilberforce Quartet. That was the university he went to initially. And then he went on to Cheney State College, which is now Cheney University in Pennsylvania, and was part of a singing group there. So he really developed his singing voice, and it really became a tool that he used. When he was traveling around the country talking about peace and social justice and racial equality, he would usually end his talks with a song of some kind, either a spiritual or a labor song or a freedom song. But also when people were on demonstrations, you might be in a very tense situation. And, you know, people are kind of lined up against each other and not sure what to do next. And sometimes Byard would just break out in a song, and it would just kind of calm things in a way, I guess you could say. It would kind of de-escalate the situation. And it was a way of nonviolently doing that.
Byard was openly gay.
Byard was out to the people that he worked with and to his family, and it did cause problems for him in his work. I know H.A. Musty, who was the head of the FOR, Fellowship of Reconciliation, was not happy about Byard being gay or even being very open about it, and it occasionally caused him problems. He was arrested here in Pasadena, California, in 1953 on a so-called morals charge, lewd vagrancy, if you will, and ended up being sentenced to 60 days. in the county jail. And he was kind of pushed out of the FOR because of that. And in the civil rights movement, you have to realize the people around Dr. King, for the most part, were people like him. They were Southern Baptist ministers. And they may have been politically liberal and left, but socially they were quite conservative and culturally quite conservative. And the idea of having this guy who was comfortable being gay and being open about it was not the easiest thing for them to take. But at the same time, Bard was so brilliant and so unique at what he did that even though he experienced periods of exile, if you will, from Dr. King's inner circle, they always ended up calling him back in, pulling him back in, because he was the only one that could do the kinds of things that he did. So they really needed him. At the same time, his being gay, I think, kept him from rising to the level of leadership and the level of influence that he could have had he not been gay.
Did he resent that at all? Did he ever think he should have just stayed in the closet?
Oh, no. I don't think he ever thought that. I think he may have been resentful, but not for long. He was somebody that cared about the work. He believed in the power of the cause. It was not about him personally. He didn't really seek leadership or aggrandizement, if you will. He really wanted to focus on the work. What he resented were people that he thought he was close to and he was loyal to, who perhaps you could say betrayed him or turned their back on him. And he was resentful about that, but he would get over it. As soon as the next picket line or the next sit-in came about, he was out there ready to go back in the fight.
This is Steve Pride, and I'm talking with Walter Nagel, the surviving partner of civil rights activist Bayard Rustin, organizer of the 1963 March on Washington. Was Bayard involved in LGBT activism?
Bayard really didn't get involved in the LGBT rights movement until fairly late in his life, during the time that I was with him. I think at that point, the movement was really expanding and spreading, and you had LGBT rights groups on campuses. Some religious organizations had their own little groups, like Integrity and Dignity and Catholic and Episcopal churches. And I think they saw Bayard as an elder, if you will, somebody who they could get lessons from. So they called him in to speak to the groups. He did a number of interviews with the LGBT press. So he was kind of seen as a senior figure, but he was not at Stonewall. He was not out there in the early days.
What would he think of where we are today?
Bayard would be very impressed with the progress that has been made. I mean, he's been dead 30 years ago this year. And he would be very impressed with just the fact that gay people can marry. Marriage is legal. I mean, we had to go through an adoption for me to have some legal rights and legal protections. Did this in 1982. So he would be impressed with the progress that we've made. But I think he knows that progress is always threatened, and you take two or three steps forward and then somebody comes and you take two or three steps back, and you just have to kind of stay in the fray and keep up the fight.
You mentioned your adoption. Talk about that.
Well, I remember we were sitting in the living room, and I think I had a copy of The Advocate. And there was an article in there about a couple in the Midwest, I think in Michigan or Wisconsin, who had tried to adopt one another, and it was denied. And Bayard, being the creative genius that he was, thought, well, you know, maybe we should see if we could do this here. New York City, it's a different place than the Midwest. And so he spoke to his lawyer, and we embarked upon the process. In retrospect, and considering what other people have had to go through, I think the process for us was relatively easy, a little humorous. Like all bureaucracies, New York has its laws and its rules that it has to follow. And there were certainly things that you had to do for adoption. And one of those things was that they had to send a social worker into the home to see if it was an appropriate home for a child. At that point, I was about a 30-year-old child. And so the social worker came in and sized up the situation pretty quickly and was very adjusted. She asked the right questions. I think the concern, of course, was that this wasn't some dotty old man who was being taken advantage of by some young kid. And equally, that there wasn't some young kid who was being taken advantage of by an older person. So she went back and filed her papers, and we waited. And eventually, a judge who I think we thought would be friendly to us came along, and we went through with it. Now, in all fairness, I would say Bayard was not an unknown person. He was a person of some celebrity, a low degree of celebrity at that time. So sometimes that plays a role in these things.
You weren't just a same-sex couple. You were also a mixed-race couple.
Looking back, I realized that being an interracial couple at that time was out of the ordinary. It hadn't been that long since Loving versus Virginia, that ruling had taken place. But at the same time, you know, we lived in New York City, and New York City is a kind of an island of sanity, if you will, a very liberal place to be, a very diverse place. You know, we'd occasionally get looks and stares, but not really any outright hostility. So I think had we lived somewhere else in the country, it would have been a very different story.
What was your life together like?
Our life together was a lot of fun, a lot of excitement, and at the same time, very ordinary day-to-day work that we did. But then the phone would ring and you could pick it up and it could be the president. It could be, you know, you just didn't know. So there was kind of an element of surprise and excitement all the time. We lived in Midtown Manhattan, and we were very close to Greenwich Village. Byard liked to spend a lot of time in the village. We had friends there. He was a collector, an appreciator of fine art, a sculpture, specifically Western European religious sculpture. So on the weekends, when if he didn't have anything to do, he would go down to the village to one of the local auctions and look around there and shop. He was happiest, I would say, when he wasn't working, if you will, when he wasn't out getting his head beaten in. He was happiest just throwing on a pair of jeans and a t-shirt and kind of wandering down in Greenwich Village and visiting the antique dealers and sitting and having tea with them and, you know, having dinner with friends.
How did Bayard Rustin die?
He died as a result of a pulmonary embolism, which developed after he had been hospitalized for a burst appendix, which at the time he was hospitalized, apparently had burst about 10 days to 2 weeks before, and he had been walking around with that. So once he was hospitalized and they opened him up and they kind of cleaned up the problem, but a couple of days later, the embolism broke free and that was it. Very sudden, kind of unexpected, certainly.
How did you cope?
It was very difficult. At the same time, Byard had a very loyal community of friends and co-workers, and I was really surrounded by a lot of love and a lot of caring, both from those people that worked with him and from my family. I have a very loving and accepting family. So I had a lot of support. And there were things that we really needed to do. We had to plan a somewhat public, of course, memorial service for Byard, and that involved a lot of logistics and a lot of organizing. And so for the first couple of months, we were all pretty busy pulling things together. I think when it really set in, probably about 6 months later, I went away for a week by myself, and that was really when it hit me. When Byard was alive, he might go away for 2 weeks at a time, 3 weeks at a time on a human rights mission or something, but he would always come back. And so it took a while for me to realize that, well, he's not coming back. But again, because of his work, and I guess to a certain degree his fame and his legacy, I always have reminders of who he was. We have him on film, we have him talking, we have him singing. People are interested in researching his life, people are writing about him, people are working on plays, there's a docudrama that's kind of in the works. And so, I mean, I don't find that painful. The memory is always there. It's not like you're going to forget somebody you loved anyway. So I'm gratified that people are celebrating who he was and celebrating his legacy and hopefully carrying on the values that he stood for. I mean, there's a lot of work to be done now, and Byard would like people to be out there speaking truth to power and fighting nonviolently to uphold the rights that we fought so dearly to win and are now being threatened.
You've done a tremendous job keeping his legacy alive. I think he'd be proud of you.
That's very nice of you to say that. I hope that Byard would be proud of me. I think, in all fairness, I've had a lot of help. I like to kind of think of myself as a facilitator, providing access to people who want to do research on him, not charging a lot of money for permissions and fees and things like that. Because I think the most important thing about him is for people to learn about him and to kind of follow in his footsteps. Doesn't mean they have to agree with him on everything. I didn't always agree with him on everything that he did or said. But the core values, the strategies and the tactics that he used, I think those are timeless. And that's what people really need to carry on in fighting.
What would surprise me about Bayard Rustin?
How lighthearted and how gentle and how spontaneous. And really, he had a great joy for life. He had gone through a lot. He had been beaten down. He had been incarcerated a number of times. But he always came back, and he was very, very resilient. You know, he didn't allow himself to become depressed, at least for very long, and he never gave up the fight. And I think people wouldn't be surprised that he was still out there fighting, but I think they would be surprised at the approach that he took going into these fights. I also think that they would be surprised that he collected wonderful works of art, largely religious of nature. As far as I know, never owned a couch, didn't have a television until A. Philip Randolph died and, you know, we got his television. His apartment was furnished with works of fine art that he was able to pick up at auctions and at flea markets, both here and on his travels around the world. So I think people would be kind of surprised at his marvelous taste in fine art.
How can listeners get more information about Bayard Rustin?
They could visit the website rustin.org, that's rustin.org, or they could find me probably on the internet. My email address is rustin, rustin, at rcn.com. I was Bayard's partner, but I was also the executor of his estate. So I have a certain amount of things still in my possession. Most of his papers and things are at the Library of Congress. But if they wanted to go beyond what's available publicly, they could get in touch with me.
This has been a conversation with Walter Nagel, the surviving partner of civil rights activist Bayard Rustin, organizer of the 1963 March on Washington. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
And as executive director of the Bayard Rustin Fund, Walter Nagel continues to commemorate Rustin's life, values, and legacy. Okay, that's it for tonight. I'm David Hunt. Our thanks to IMRU's executive producer, Steve Pride, and Rainbow Minute producers, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns. Please follow us on Facebook at IMRU Radio. And if you're interested in volunteering with IMRU in any capacity, email public@prideonscreen.com. And a reminder, we're a global podcast as well as a show broadcast by KPFK Los Angeles. You can always hear our weekly show posted to kpfk.org. Also, catch us at iTunes, Spotify, Breaker, Anchor.fm, CastBox, and Pocket Cast. I'm David Hunt. You can find me at tellmedavid.com. So long, and thanks for listening.
My mama told me when I was young, we're all born superstars.
Mama done told you.
She rolled her hair and put her lipstick on in the glass of her boudoir. There's nothing wrong with loving who you are, she said, 'cause I made you perfect, babe. So hold your head up, boy, and you'll go far. Listen to me when I say,
I'm beautiful.